This is VOA News. Via remote, I'm Diane Roberts. Israel has launched an airstrike into Syria, killing a soldier and injuring several others. AP correspondent Karen Chames reports.
Mr. Speaker, in the last few...
Israeli military said it attacked targets near Damascus shortly after an anti-aircraft missile was fired from the Arab country into northern Israel. Israel said the Syrian rocket exploded in the air and was not intercepted by Israeli air defenses, but it activated warning sirens in northern Israel. There were no reports of injuries or damage in Israel. In a rare statement acknowledging attacks inside Syria, the Israeli army said it struck Syrian facilities used in targeting Israeli aircraft, including a radar and anti-aircraft batteries. I'm Karen Chames.
Australia's Foreign Minister Maurice Payne says Secretary of State Antony Blinken and key allies are, quote, voting with their feet, end quote, by flying to Australia to focus on challenges in the Indo-Pacific region. Blinken landed in the Australian city of Melbourne Wednesday ahead of a meeting with Payne, as well as their Indian and Japanese counterparts who form the so-called Quad. It will be the fourth such ministerial-level meeting of a bloc of Indo-Pacific democracies created to counter China. The visit comes as tensions between Washington and Moscow continue to escalate over Ukraine. French President Emmanuel Macron says Russian President Vladimir Putin told him that Moscow would not further escalate the Ukraine crisis. Macron also said it would take time to find a diplomatic solution to the rising tensions. His remarks on a visit to Kiev came after the Kremlin denied reports that he and Putin struck a deal during marathon talks Monday. And UK troops have joined NATO allies for military exercises in Estonia amid heightened tensions between Ukraine and Russia. This is VOA News. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson was quizzed earlier Wednesday by lawmakers about a photo published by the Daily Mirror newspaper showing him at a Christmas party during December 2020 when restrictions on gatherings were in place. This as it relates to an investigation by civil servant Sue Gray into parties held at number 10 Downing Street.
Mr. Speaker, in the last few minutes, a photo has emerged of the Prime Minister in Downing Street on the 15th of December 2020, surrounded by alcohol, food, and people wearing tinsel. It looks a lot like one of the Christmas parties he told us never happened.
But in what he has just said, I'm afraid he is completely in error.
Lawmakers contend this is a new party not being investigated, while the Prime Minister said the event has been submitted for investigation. Students from all across India extended their support Wednesday to Muslim women students in southern Karnataka state who had been barred from entering the college if they wear a hijab. Students took to the streets holding placards and banners and raised slogans against the government. In the Karnataka state's Mandi town, a Muslim woman student became an internet sensation Tuesday as she was seen chanting an Islamic phrase to counter a crowd of students shouting Hindu slogans while supporting the government's decision on the hijab ban. Japan's prime minister announced plans Wednesday to extend COVID-19 restrictions in Tokyo and 12 other areas for 3 more weeks as cases of the Omicron variant remain high. Fumio Kishida said he planned to hold a virus task force meeting Thursday and would be, quote, careful about the risk of hindering the maintenance of social economic activities, end quote. The rollout of booster vaccines has also been criticized as too slow, with only about 7.2% of Japan's population fully vaccinated with these shots. The foreign ministers of Australia and Lithuania have agreed to step up cooperation on strategic challenges, in particular pressures from China. Lithuania's foreign minister and his Australian counterpart met Wednesday at Parliament House. Lithuania drew Beijing's ire after agreeing that Taiwan's office in Vilnius would bear the name Taiwan instead of Chinese Taipei. The U.S. Justice Department announced Tuesday's largest ever financial seizure, more than $3.6 billion, and the arrest of a New York couple accused of conspiring to launder billions of dollars in cryptocurrency stolen from the 2016 hack of a virtual currency exchange. Federal law enforcement officials said the recovered sum was linked to the hack of Bitfinex, a virtual currency exchange. By remote, Diane Roberts, VOA News.
Today is Wednesday, February 9th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Afua in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, Baltic states call for more military assistance from Europe amid Russia-Ukraine tensions.
There are certain things what we would like to see. Some of our larger and stronger European allies could follow, for instance, example of United States, because you know that United States are giving quite large military assistance.
President Joe Biden speaks to head of the Central Command, warns that Al-Qaeda and ISIS are, quote, reconstituting, unquote.
This is a critical time for the 21 countries of Central Command. The United States faces a new era of strategic competition with China and Russia that is not confined to one geographical region and extends into the CENTCOM area of responsibility.
And retired Pope Benedict XVI asks for forgiveness for, quote, grievous faults, unquote, in his handling of clergy sex abuse cases. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. Latvian Defense Minister Artis Pabriks is calling for more military assistance to Baltic states from their European partners, noting the, quote, good example, unquote, of the United States in supporting the three countries. Pabriks says Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania are protecting the borders of the European Union and NATO, and that it should be, quote, taken into account, unquote, by countries in Western Europe when thinking about where to put military and financial support. He says countries like Germany will definitely be capable of giving support similar to the US, noting financial and contributions in many other ways, unquote. Berlin announced on Monday it will send an additional 350 troops to Lithuania.
We would be willing to see also such kind of eagerness from other NATO allies in Europe. And I think there are certain things what we would like to see. Some of our larger and stronger European allies could follow, for instance, example of United States. Because you know that United States are giving quite large military assistance also to Baltic countries. It's financial assistance, it's contributions in many other ways. And, you know, we are here. We are not only defending our national borders against the Russian and Belarusian hybrid migrant attacks or something else. We are also countries which have EU and NATO border. So I think it would be just fine if this would be taken into account also by our friends in more Western parts of Europe. And I mean, American example is, I think, a good example. Why couldn't we have a little bit kind of sharing of these necessities to assist us to protect our borders also within or among the European nations, not only when there are finances flowing across the Atlantic Ocean from United States to the Baltics, but I believe that such countries as Germans would definitely be capable also to give such type of assistance also to us here. And I'm not begging this because, you know, we are poor guys and we want to live on the expense of somebody else. Not at all. But I think this would be exactly that common sense which is dictated by those current challenges what we see around.
That's Latvian Defense Minister Artis Pabriks. More United States soldiers and equipment arrived on military planes at Zezaujasionka Airport in southeastern Poland on Tuesday. Hundreds of U.S. soldiers arrived on a chartered Boeing 747 in Zezau, located about 100 kilometers from Ukraine's border. A plane of this type can carry more than 400 passengers, and the group is the largest so far to arrive of a deployment of 1,700 service members to Poland. They're mobilizing in response to worries over the impact of NATO's eastern flank in the event of a Russian invasion of Ukraine. Other smaller groups of soldiers arrived on U.S. Air Force C-17 planes, bringing vehicles and equipment on Monday and Tuesday. NATO says Russia has more than 100,000 troops stationed on Ukraine's borders, including 30,000 in Belarus for joint military exercises this month. Moscow denies it is planning to invade Ukraine, but says it wants security guarantees that includes a promise of no missile deployment near its borders and a scaling back of NATO's military infrastructure. The International Committee of the Red Cross says every day is a struggle for survival for hundreds of thousands of Ukrainians and Russians living along the border between the two countries. Last weekend, a delegation from the ICRC visited the Ukraine-Russian border. VOA's Carol Van Dam asked the spokesperson for the group, Oleksandr Visenko, how much food and fuel for heating the ICRC has delivered to people living near the border since the crisis began.
The hottest period of time, there were 2014 and 15. And during this period of time, we have more people to assist with our direct assistance. I mean, distribution of our food parcels and hygiene parcels. Probably in this period of time, we had about 80,000 people monthly because we do it every month. Now we reduce this number to about 25,000 per month, and we are only supporting those vulnerable, very vulnerable people living in very vulnerable places, usually in gray zone, where about 5, 10, 15, 20 people left, and usually they are very elderly people. No, nowhere to go and nothing to do because there's no any shops, even just to spend their money. If we, for example, replace it for financial support, like we did in some other locations, which are less vulnerable and a bit further from the contact line. So yes, we're trying to move from this distribution of our food and hygiene parcels to financial assistance and to support of, let's call it, microeconomical initiatives when people can earn money by themselves, and we support their business starts. And of course, in some cases, we also provide some kind of consultations about how to start their business, just for you to understand. It's very small businesses.
Take me through the process of how it works exactly. Like, pretend I'm one of those aid workers on the ground. What am I doing with the fuel and the food? How am I getting it to these people?
All our assistance starts with assessing people's needs. Actually, we did it in 2014 mostly. And now we have just the list of our beneficiaries. If some people, if their, for example, life conditions has changed, of course, we put them in our list. But usually working with the local authorities to understand who we have to support. We have our internal rules, and it's not like something to change.
For instance, what kind of fuel are you talking about? Is it that liquefied gas? And also, what kind of basic food are you...
No. If you, we have a separate program of, call it, winterization. It means preparation for winter. Because in this part of the world, as you know, being living in DC, that it's rather cold during winter time, a bit different from our other contexts, major in Africa or in Middle East, when we have no such program. But here in Ukraine, if you are living in your private house, you have to heat your habitat somehow. Yes. We distribute firewoods, like briquettes, and people actually happy with it. In some cases, we have financial supports, and people can spend money for this. We have no medical assistance directly to people. We are assisting medical institutions because you never can understand and realize what kind of medical assistance people need. Actually, this is the doctor who have to realize this. That's why we are supporting medical institutions.
That's the spokesperson for the ICRC Ukrainian delegation, Oleksandr Visenko, speaking from Kyiv with my colleague Carol Van Dam. Tomorrow is the second part of their conversation. Visenko describes the relationship between Russians and Ukrainians living near the border as fears mount of a Russian invasion. The Ukrainian military says the number of artillery attacks on the border between Ukraine and the Russian-occupied Donetsk and Luhansk regions have decreased, though Moscow continues to mass troops just inside its border. Reporter Victor Lamar traveled to the region and found people there hoping for peace but preparing for war. Anna Rice narrates his story.
In Zolotoye, a town in the Luhansk region of eastern Ukraine, Ukrainian soldiers are keeping watch in the area. Civilians live in this area as well, and gunfire is common. 70-year-old Alexandra Gerasimova says she's used to it, but the livestock are not.
Don't be afraid, Marusia. Don't fuss. No one will hurt you, no. Here, look, this got broken in 2017. We had no windows left. I had to put in new ones. These were broken too. Those as well. There was nothing here after a missile fell here.
Nikolai's yard was hit by a missile a few weeks ago. The resident of the Stanitsa Luhanska says there are also mines.
They're laying mines here. I keep finding ropes here. You know, the ones for mines. I don't know how they are used exactly.
The Ukrainian military says the self-proclaimed Luhansk People's Republic is deploying anti-personnel landmines, banned not just by the Minsk Agreement, but also by international conventions. Just a few weeks ago, this village of Novozvanivka in the Luhansk region was in the middle of attacks and gunfire. It's relatively quiet here now. But still, the Ukrainian military have noticed some movement. According to Ukrainian intelligence, Russian troops are actively training, and they have set up artillery units near the border. The Ukrainian military says it won't be surprised if one day they see the cannons at firing ranges pointed at them. But they say they're not panicked and instead are prepared for what comes next. For Victor Limar in the Luhansk region, NRI's VOA News.
U.S. President Joe Biden's pick to head the Central Command, Lieutenant General Michael Kurila, warned in a Senate confirmation hearing on Tuesday that Al-Qaeda and ISIS are, quote, reconstituting, unquote. He added that Iran was the number one destabilizing factor in the Middle East and that any agreement with them, quote, should make sure they do not get a nuclear weapon, unquote. Kurila, who is part of the task force overseeing troops deployment amid escalating tensions between Ukraine and Russia, said he was, quote, very concerned about a Russian incursion invasion into Ukraine, unquote.
This is a critical time for the 21 countries of Central Command. The United States faces a new era of strategic competition with China and Russia that is not confined to one geographical region and extends into the CENTCOM area of responsibility. The Middle East, Central, and South Asia remain complex and dynamic environments. CENTCOM remains a dangerous theater with its own internal threats to American security. The CENTCOM theater is also burdened by civil war and humanitarian crisis. The area is home to 9 of the top 10 most dangerous violent extremist organizations, including Al-Qaeda and ISIS, which are both reconstituting. All of these ill trends are accelerated by water scarcity and food insecurity. China has significantly increased its investment and influence in the region, and Russia acts as a spoiler. If confirmed as the CENTCOM commander, I will protect American interests in the region with these challenges in mind. Well, one of the challenges is the threat to the homeland from Al-Qaeda and ISIS-K. They are reconstituting. The Taliban has not renounced Al-Qaeda. ISIS-K, with the release of the prisoners both from the Bagram prison and Pol-Sharkey, are in the process of reconstituting. While they have aspirations to attack the homeland, they do not have the capability yet. Additionally, we have the humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan. I believe there are opportunities in the future of ways that we can work with perhaps the World Food Program and others in the region to help alleviate some of that burden on the humanitarian crisis. I've not always seen eye to eye with Pakistan, but I do think we have a shared interest in regional stability and countering violent extremist organizations. One of the most violent is Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistani, the TTP, which directly threatens Pakistan. Also, the humanitarian crisis inside of Afghanistan threatens the migrants to push into and refugees to push into Pakistan. So I think there's potentially some shared interest that we can work with them on counter VEOs and the humanitarian crisis.
That's President Joe Biden speak to head Central Command, Lieutenant General Michael Kurila. The U.S. military stepping up support to the United Arab Emirates after a series of missiles and drone attacks launched by Yemen's Houthi rebels. U.S. General Frank McKinsey, head of the U.S. Central Command overseeing American forces in the Middle East, has been in the UAE to bolster defenses. Analysts say the attacks on the Gulf nation could hurt its reputation as a stable business and tourist hub with tough security. Dave Gavlak reports from Amman.
Speaking from the United Arab Emirates, U.S. General Frank McKenzie says battlefield setbacks in Yemen by Iran-backed Houthi rebels may have prompted recent attacks on the UAE capital, Abu Dhabi, where a military base also hosts U.S. troops. The 7-year Yemen war has pit Houthis against government forces backed by Saudi Arabia and an Arab coalition, including the UAE. The conflict, viewed as a proxy war involving Iran, has killed tens of thousands of Yemenis, sparking one of the world's worst humanitarian crises. U.S. and United Nations officials have documented Iran smuggling high-end weapons to the Houthis. Medium-range ballistic missiles were fired from Yemen and entered UAE were not invented, built, designed in Yemen, McKenzie says. So I think we certainly see the Iranian connection to this. Giuseppe Dentese heads the Middle East desk at Rome's Center for International Studies. He told VOA that the Houthis are using the attacks to leverage their demands.
Is a strong and symbolic sign that shows how no one in the Gulf is safe and that the Houthi have the capability to hit all these countries in the area. Maybe the main risk is growing internationalization of the conflict with a widening front of new players. For example, Israel, that is interested to support Abu Dhabi to confront Iran in any scenario of this crisis. This attack aimed to weak commercial tourism financial hub in the Gulf.
Dr. Andreas Krieg, an associate professor at the School of Security at King's College in London, agrees that the Houthi attacks pose a menace to the UAE's standing as the key commercial and tourism hub in the Gulf and could hurt its safe reputation for finance and security. This is a major reputational damage to the idea of the UAE being one of the safest and more secure countries in the world, Craig told the New Arab Online publication. The fact that air defenses were unable to protect very critical infrastructure is definitely something the UAE will now have to consider. Until recently, the UAE had been immune from such outright missile and drone attacks that the Houthis have rained down on neighboring Saudi Arabia. The Pentagon says advanced F-22 fighter jets are being sent to the UAE and a guided missile destroyer, the USS Cole, will aid its Navy to surveil Gulf waters for shipments of contraband. U.S. President Joe Biden says Washington is considering redesignating the Houthis as an international terrorist organization, a label which was rescinded last February. The UAE has called for the designation to be restored. Dale Gavlek for VOA News, Amman.
In other news, retired Pope Benedict XVI is asking for forgiveness for, quote, any grievous faults, unquote, in his handling of clergy sex abuse cases. But he is not admitting to any personal or specific wrongdoing after an independent report criticized his actions in four cases while he was Archbishop of Munich, Germany. Benedict's lack of personal apology or admission of guilt immediately raised sex abuse survivors who said his response reflected what they call the Catholic hierarchy's, quote, permanent refusal to accept responsibility for the rape and sodomy of children by priests. The German Church commissioned the report from a German law firm to look into how cases of sexual abuse were handled in Munich archdiocese that a retired pope had led from 1977 to 1982. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voanews.com. Remember to connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Search for VOA Africa. You are listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofo in Washington. The UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, warns the Horn of Africa is facing a climate-induced emergency and says the international community must act now to prevent a catastrophic loss of life and livelihoods. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The specter of the 2011 famine in Somalia hangs over the dire situation confronting millions of people in the Horn of Africa. That emergency killed 250,000 people, half of them children. Hunger and malnutrition have worsened in the region after 3 years of consecutive drought. But famine has not been reported in any area. UN agencies, however, say that could rapidly change. The UN Children's Fund predicts as many as 20 million people in Eritrea, Ethiopia, Kenya, and Somalia will need water and food assistance in the next 6 months. Mohamed Malik Fall is UNICEF Eastern and Southern African Regional Director. Speaking on a line from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, he says children will be among the biggest victims of this crisis.
Right now, nearly 5.5 million children in these four countries are threatened by acute malnutrition and an estimated 1.4 million children by severe acute malnutrition. UNICEF fears that this number will increase by 50% if the rain don't come in the next 3 months.
Three dry seasons in a row have decimated crops, led to severe water scarcity, and killed livestock. This has forced families to leave their homes in search of grazing land and water, increasing the risk of disease and severe malnutrition. The World Food Program estimates 13 million people across Ethiopia, Kenya, and Somalia are gripped by severe hunger. UNICEF's Mohamed Fall says children caught in this climate emergency are missing out on meals, on school, and on access to life-saving health services.
Families are taking extreme measures to survive and in many cases leaving their home, which put children on the move at particular risk. This is a crisis that required a collective response, ensuring access to clean water, nutrition, and safe space for children.
UNICEF is appealing for $123 million to provide life-saving aid for the most vulnerable in the four countries until the end of June. It warns many children will die or end up with lifelong cognitive or physical damage if the international community fails to act quickly. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Lou Risa.